These Days.
Kids These Days.
This is Kids These Days.
Innovation, creativity, and progressiveness. These are some of the things that have helped America become what it is today. Whether you see it in a former Alaskan winning the Nobel Prize in Physics, or in Steve Jobs and his life as a technology pioneer, helping those of us who are capable of doing exceptional things do those things, well, it's important. So today on the program, we're discussing gifted and talented education in our state. Each district has its own approach, and today we find out how Alaskans and others support our best and brightest. That's today on Kids These Days. Hi, I'm Shanna Sheehy. Each week, Kids These Days takes on a new topic that's of interest to all of us in the 49th state. And today we're discussing how we educate our gifted kids. What do you think? Are you the product of so-called tracking? Are you a parent of a gifted kid with an opinion? Well, we want to hear from you, whoever you are. Write to us at mail@kidsthesedays.org, or you can comment directly on our website or through our Facebook page. I'm joined today by three fine guests. Peter Lubicich is supervisor of the Anchorage School District's Gifted Program and Highly Gifted Program. Peter grew up in Anchorage and attended ASD schools. He's now in his 15th year as an educator there. Peter was a teacher in the Gifted Program for a long time before he became supervisor. He's also the parent of a current ASD student. Thanks, Peter, for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Annie Bill is a longtime Alaska resident who's lived and worked in the Matanuska-Susitna Valley for more than 25 years. She's worked with gifted and talented students at the elementary and middle school levels in the Mat-Su Borough School District, both as a teacher and as a principal. She's now coordinating the Talented and Gifted program there. Annie studied this area of education and has personal experience with the parenting challenges of raising a gifted child. Thanks to you, Annie, for being with us.
You're welcome. Good morning.
And Susan Dulong Langley serves as the parent representative to the board of directors for the National Association for Gifted Children. She's the mother of a grown daughter who sparked her interest in the field, and she's a full-time teacher of gifted and talented students in grades 3 through 8 in Massachusetts. Susan's also an adjunct professor at the University of Connecticut, where she teaches a class in talent development in the arts. She also holds a master's degree from that same university in gifted education. Susan is joining us by phone today, and thanks to you, Susan, for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me, and also for shining the light on this really important topic.
Well, let me first ask you, Susan, to describe a little bit about the National Association for Gifted Children, on which you're a board member.
Certainly. The National Association for Gifted Children is an advocacy organization of parents, professionals, and others who are interested in the needs of this very diverse population of learners. There is a very wide discrepancy among all 50 states, where some states have identification policies, some have funding, some have nothing, some have a great many resources. And so NAGC is an umbrella organization working to legislate so that there's equity for all children of needs.
And I believe, as I was doing some research, I learned that there are at least 37 states that have some sort of mandate to address the needs of gifted and talented students in public schools. But your organization helps any state or any group or school that's interested in doing such a thing?
Absolutely. And that's where we may be of the most service, because if you don't have something in place in your state, we can be there as a resource to help partner with you, help to partner with other states and organizations.
Well, let's talk about our state, Alaska. The Anchorage School District and the Matanuska-Susitna Borough School District are the two largest in Alaska. So how is it, and I'll start with you, Peter, how is it that our state develops its gifted and talented programs as part of special education, or maybe that's special to each district?
Gifted was in Alaska under special education until about 2002, when we were removed from that umbrella. Currently, every district in Alaska, by state regulation, is required to provide some service for gifted children, but what's provided is up to the individual district, and then each district has to submit a plan to the state that specifies how you're identifying children, what criteria are used to qualify them and what services are provided.
Okay, so let's talk about that. I want to find out, how is it that young, that kids are identified for a gifted program of whatever kind in a district? Actually, Annie, maybe you can pick that up.
Sure. Well, at the MATSU, we look at children in the primary years, starting at second grade, and we look for those children that are demonstrating high aptitude at both reading, writing, and language usage by demonstrated on the measures of academic progress, which is a nationally normed assessment. And we take the kids that are in the 95th percentile or higher in all three areas, and then we put them through a series of evaluations. And we have a matrix where we look at what their score is from a Woodcock-Johnson 3 academic intelligence test, and then we look at how they are performing in the regular classroom, and recommendations from teachers and parents, and then we put that all together and make a decision on whether or not the child is following what is recommended by NAGC as a classic gifted child. That's how MATSU does their identification.
Mm-hmm. And I'd like to know also, before we get too far from what you said, this idea of percentile, so a child who's performing in 95th percentile or somewhere in that area, how does a parent understand what that means? Like, what does that mean, 95th percentile?
Well, you know, it depends on what you're comparing it with. So you're looking for a certain percentage of the population that is can be 2 to 3 grade levels beyond their peers. And so if you look at a normed test, with the with millions of children across the country, you can compare your child with that group and say, okay, they're in the top 2%, or they're in the top 5%. And then from that, you have a good starting point to assess whether or not the child really is in a gifted status.
Mm-hmm. And Peter Lubicich, does this happen in the same sort of way in the Acres School District as well, identifying children who would be qualifying for gifted programs?
Similarly, yes. We typically use a 96th percentile criteria on achievement and ability assessments. Recommendations from teachers, and students can even refer themselves, which happens from time to time as well. It's really interesting when a student comes to one of us and says they want to be in our program, and what do I have to do?
And what do you say when a student does that?
Well, I discuss that with the student. We just explain the criteria and what we do in the program. And, of course, we talk it over with the parents, who have to give permission for this to take place. But lots of students that refer themselves end up qualifying, too.
Susan Dulong-Langley, I'm wondering also, you know, there are these different tools to assess kids at different ages for ability, cognitive ability, and I'm sure achievement, like how well they can do in school and so forth, and general smarts like IQ and so forth. But how reliable are tests of this nature?
There are a couple different questions, I think, embedded in that main question, one of which is, if you're selecting instruments, you want to make sure that they have been rigorously tested to be shown to be both valid and reliable. And additionally, you want to make sure that they're then being used in appropriate ways. I loved where Annie was speaking about the matrix approach, where it's never just one test on one given day. It's recommended that there are a variety of measures that really are designed to tease out the best that a student has, because sometimes their gifts are more manifest, but sometimes they're more latent. You know, you don't always see giftedness in the way that you think that it would look. So a variety of measures that are valid and reliable and that are culturally sensitive and also take into account those students that we refer to as twice exceptional. For example, students who might have a learning disability in conjunction with their intellectual giftedness. So it's a really complex subject, and there are many ways to approach it. The main recommendation is to match the identification measures to the programming that would then be provided.
Mm-hmm. And you say that sometimes giftedness might not manifest itself in a way that seems obvious or a natural way of manifesting. Can you give me an example of how that might be seen in an unusual way or unexpected way?
Correct. Sometimes we receive calls from parents whose children were referred for special education testing. They weren't performing in the classroom. The teachers or counselors were trying to get to the bottom of behaviors that they were seeing. And while they were looking for deficits, in turn, what they ended up finding were true exceptionalities of intellect. I'm thinking in particular of one case where a young child was ultimately then grade skipped, three grades, because the need was so great, but the initial testing had been done because he wasn't performing in the classroom and there were resulting behavioral problems. That's an extreme case, but it does highlight that it's a very complex situation that looks very different from child to child. So we need professionals who are very much aware of how these things may look and are vested in really searching them out.
Annie Bill, did you want to follow up?
One of the things we need to keep remembering is that there's a whole spectrum of giftedness that can run from logical mathematical to emotional giftedness or kinesthetic giftedness. And different children, different people have different levels in all areas. And so many of the classic examinations that are used, like the Woodcock-Johnson 3, just tests logical mathematical or best test logical mathematical intelligence. So just by virtue of using those instruments, we may be leaving out a significant portion of the population that has giftedness in other areas, or that's not their strength area. So as Susan mentioned, we need to look at the whole child, the whole picture, social, emotional, academic, just the whole picture.
Mm-hmm. And Susan also mentioned cultural sensitivity. One of the persistent issues that comes up with gifted and talented education is that too few minority students tend to be included in the programs. Nationally, Native Americans, Hispanics, and African Americans have been underrepresented in gifted and talented programs. Kids These Days regular contributor Jessica Cochran reports.
Donna Ford has been studying minority underrepresentation in gifted and talented programs for about 20 years. During that time, she's seen some improvement in the numbers. Native Americans are more equitably represented than they used to be, and Hispanics have seen some gains. But African Americans have not.
We're just not making much progress with this population. So we still, meaning African Americans, hover at around 45 to 50% underrepresentation nationally in our gifted programs.
Ford, an education professor at Vanderbilt University, believes the primary reason for the discrepancies lies at the beginning of the process for identifying gifted kids. In most districts, it starts with a teacher referral.
Biases and stereotypes and deficit thinking in teachers' minds about Black and Hispanic students, especially if they live in poverty, prevents them without a doubt from making these referrals or completing a teacher checklist, for example, or a nomination form. And then after that, when they're, you know, in the pool, then these tests, which I believe still contain bias from an economic and cultural and linguistic perspective, contribute to the problem.
She says solving the problem has to be individual to each district to address the cultural issues in that area. And it needs to be based on data.
Looking at the magnitude of underrepresentation, and then look at it by gender, look at it by race, look at it by income. And then once we have the data, let's look at what is contributing to the discrepancy. So what policies and procedures are problematic, and what attitudes are problematic. So if our school district relies on teacher referrals as the first step, and teachers are not referring Black, Hispanic, and or low-income students, then why do we continue to use teacher referral? If teacher referral is not a problem and we find that Black, Hispanic, or low-income students are not testing well on whatever measure we're using, why do we keep using that measure? If teacher referral is not an issue, if testing is not an issue, then let's explore what other things are issues. Are kids facing negative peer pressure? Just what is the issue?
Nationally, researchers like Joseph Renzulli at the National Research Center on the Gifted and Talented have developed systems to identify both kids who test well in traditional methods and those whose strengths may lie in other areas. One Alaska school administrator had a plan to increase the representation. Back in 1991, Linda Manuel was in charge of gifted education for the Lower Kuskokwim School District in Bethel. She wrote a paper describing the method the district used to identify gifted and talented kids. It looked at 6 ability areas, including intellectual, leadership, creativity, and artistic or performing arts. She reported that using the new criteria increased the number of students identified for the program by 50%. But 20 years later, her district doesn't have a gifted program. Calls to the district to follow up were not returned. Vanderbilt's Donna Ford says that's another major problem with gifted education. For all kids, but especially low-income kids, it just hasn't received that much attention in what she calls our nation's triage approach to education.
So this academic or medical triage model is sabotaging the future and potential of gifted students in general, but our low-income, gifted, and or highly able students in particular. And this is one reason we have this international gap or this global gap where the U.S. cannot or is not, let me just say, is not competing globally in math, science, engineering, technology, and the language arts as well.
The National Association for Gifted Children is working to pass the Talent Act. It's designed to make sure qualified students are identified for gifted and talented programs. It would require states to report on the progress of its high-achieving students, and low-income schools would have to describe how they use federal Title I funds to serve their high-achieving students. I'm Jessica Cochran.
This is Kids These Days. What do you think about focusing special attention and giving extra educational opportunities to some of our brightest young Alaskans? Let us know. Comment on our Facebook page or on our website. The conversation starts now, right here on the radio, and continues all week long on kidsthesedays.org. I'm Shanna Sheehy, and I'm talking today about gifted and talented education in our state with Peter Lubajich of the Anchorage School District, Annie Bill of the Matanuska-Susitna Borough School District, and Susan Dulong Langley of the National Association for Gifted Children. And after hearing Jessica's report about minorities and representation in gifted and talented education, it brings up lots of questions for me. And it's also a great place, maybe, Susan, to ask you about kind of the state of gifted and talented education right now with respect to current educational policy. I've read a lot of opinions out there about how No Child Left Behind is affecting or not affecting gifted education. Could you make some comments about that?
Thank you, absolutely. As mentioned earlier, there is no overarching federal policy. So it is up to every individual state as to what, if anything, they would like to do for this population of learners. And if they choose to do something, it's up to them how they will identify them, if they will provide funding. And from there, it just degenerates down to states that have no mandate to identify or to serve the students. And the great disservice is we have educators coming out of their teacher preparation programs as graduates. And there have been studies done that show that while there is a focus in their studies on other special populations, gifted and talented is not included in that. And gifted and talented can be a little bit of a problematic term, and the field is aware that it can be somewhat stigmatizing, but it's truly looking for those students who need more. And it's not extra attention. It is simply appropriate educational opportunity so that every child can make growth and learn something new in their programming. So when you talk about the impact the NCLB has had, and they're really working at that on reauthorizing it as they've been working on it for the past few years, they're starting to take that deeper look into what's called a growth model to say, who is this student? Where were they academically when they came in at the beginning of the year? And in a year's time, have they made a year's worth of growth? Which that was the challenge under NCLB. It wasn't measuring students that way. It was measuring entire cohorts of students against different students coming years after them so that they had ceilinged measures. If a student came in as a third grader reading at an eighth grade level, the test at the beginning of the year merely measured, are they reading at a third grade level? Yes. Well, at the end of the year, that test was still measuring, are they reading at a third grade level? Yes. It doesn't reflect, well, they came in at an eighth grade reading level, have they now made a year's worth of progress in that respect?
Interesting. I thought also interesting your distinction between extra attention and appropriate attention to kids of this population of learners.
Right. What we find is that when there is no programming in place, and because there has not been that focus for teachers in their teacher preparation on manageable ways to differentiate for their needs within the classroom, what oftentimes happens is we'll hear from parents, their children are being pressed into service as tutors for other children, which is, you know, a great quality to be, you know, cooperative and working. But the research shows that that's not making growth for the child that's doing the tutoring. And while, yes, there's time for cooperative work, there's also the zone of proximal development. What does an individual child need to make progress to the next level? They need something within a next challenge range to make that growth.
Annie Bill, in the Matanuska Susitna Borough School District, going back to the piece that we had prepared for Kids These Days about minorities in gifted and talented education, how is it that the Mat-Su Borough School District ensures that there's good representation of all different cultural and ethnic backgrounds in your programs?
So what we do is we teach through professional development the teachers to know how to recognize the classic traits for gifted kids, regardless of their cultural background. And then they, in turn, work with the staff at the individual schools to look over those children and see what their growth is for the year. And when Susan mentioned that growth model, that is so important. For example, so much of the school improvement effort in our state, in our country, has been focused on those low-achieving or underachieving students, regardless of their socioeconomic background or cultural background. For the last 5 to 8 years, so much effort has gone to that direction. We are just now getting to the point where we're starting to focus on the children that are not achieving through their annual growth at the other end. And so I think it's just it's a process, and we're all getting to the point right now where we're going, with the response to intervention and response to instruction process, let's look at those children and make sure that third grader who came in reading at an eighth grade level is making at least 1 year's worth of growth. And you do that with an assessment that doesn't just measure that particular grade level, but measures on a continuum. And in the Mat-Su, what we're doing is we have our measures of academic progress, our MAP assessment, and I've got scores here. We look at our children across, for example, a second grader may be performing at the seventh grade level with a math score of, 249. And so what we would be looking at the beginning of the year was, okay, that's where they scored at the beginning of the year. Then we're expecting them to be at least at 255 at the end of that year, so they've got that year's worth of growth. What the Mat-Su is doing then is looking at that year's worth of growth for every student in reading, writing, and language usage. Hopefully, in that process, we will pick up not just the classic, you know, kids, but all the kids of any special minority group.
Mm-hmm. And Peter Lubavitch, I'd like to just ask that same question of the Anchorage School District. How is it that the Anchorage School District tries to make sure that there's equity when it comes to, you know, children of all backgrounds, cultural backgrounds, being included in gifted education if they qualify?
Well, that's an important question, and it's something that we're watching very closely in our district. As of now, Anchorage is basically a minority-majority district, so that issue is very, very critical in what we're doing. Over the last several years, we've discovered, as we've talked about, many teachers have no training whatsoever in the needs of gifted children. And our staff, if we want that training to take place, we have to do it ourselves in many cases. There are teachers in our program will offer courses through the university for other teachers to spread the word and get the knowledge out there. To further address the questions, and the speaker noted that it was district by district, but I find that it's school by school. We have to look at each school individually, starting at a young age. And our staff has to do the outreach and the communication appropriate to the school. In some buildings, large numbers of referrals just kind of come in. At other schools, our staff has to be active. We have to be out there talking with the teachers, discussing the needs of the students, looked over the data. Have we found students that are advanced in your school? And encourage teachers to make referrals. And in that way, we're finding many kids are meeting our criteria and qualifying for our programs that would not have been noticed previously. So as we look at that data, I review that regularly. Our program itself is becoming more and more diverse every year. And if we compare our program numbers to the district as a whole, we're more diverse than a number of many of the schools in the district right now and still working towards that end.
Interesting. Well, this is Kids These Days, and I'm Shanna Sheehy. You're listening to this independently produced program on your very own Alaska Public Radio station. Kids These Days is created by the Content Producers Guild and distributed through a partnership with the Alaska Public Radio Network. We record our show in the studios of KSKA-FM in Anchorage. Stay with us for more conversation about talented and gifted education in the second half of the show, when I'm back with Susan Dulong Langley, Peter Lubichich, and Annie Bill. Also still to come, we hear one teenager's perspective on what it's like being both talented and gifted in today's world. Stay with us for that and more after a quick break.
Teach the gifted children. Teach them to have mercy. Teach them about sunsets. Teach them about moonrise. Teach them about anger, the sin that comes with dawning. Teach them about flowers and the beauty of forgetfulness. Then take me to the river.
Take me to the river
and put me in the water. Bless them and forgive them.
Halloween is coming, and many kids, caretakers, and community members look forward to getting dressed up and pretending to be something or someone else for a day. So next time on Kids These Days, the topic is pretending. Many say that play is a child's work. So just how do pretending, playing, and imagining play a part in helping us grow up? Find out by joining us next time. We're back. You're tuned in to Kids These Days. Today, our conversation is about gifted and talented young Alaskans and how we educate students with accelerated abilities in our state. I'm Shanna Sheehy, and with me to do that is Susan Dulong Langley, Annie Bill, and Peter Lubichich. To start the second half of this show, I want to talk about social-emotional learning. We talked about social-emotional learning a little bit in the first half, but I learned that it's estimated that 20 to 25% of gifted children may have social and emotional difficulties, which is about twice as many as in the general population of students. And that number comes from your organization, Susan, the National Association for Gifted Children. Maybe someone can explain, you know, what social emotional disabilities looks like for, or not disabilities, but difficulties looks like in a gifted student, and then why they may be more prevalent in this population. I'll look at you, Annie.
A gifted child looks at the world differently than another person. And they learn things quicker, many of them. They learn things in a broader range of perspective than others. And so at times they can't relate to or they can't communicate with their peers in the same way that other peers do. And so it sets up a setting for anxiety for them. They also oftentimes are very good at what they do, and especially when they're early in their childhood lives. And so then when they get older, say, late elementary or the middle school years, all of a sudden things become more challenging for them, and that is such a strange feeling for them that they often shut down, or they're perfectionistic, and if it's not going to work just the way they want, they'll give up, and all of this is affecting them socially and emotionally. So as a parent and as an educator, what we want to do is we want to try to first understand where the child is coming from, and then help them, advocate for them, so they can learn how to deal with their social-emotional challenges and where to get help. And then, of course, as educators and folks with the school district, we also want to make sure we offer that kind of advocacy for parents. Because for parents, raising these children can often be extremely challenging, and we need help.
Peter, do you have anything to add to that?
I think this is a critical area, and in our district, to that end, we have a social-emotional teacher that concentrates on those needs with the kids, and also a behavioral strategist, because students are individuals, behaviors and characteristics are all over the map, but we have to work real hard to figure out what's getting in the way of them achieving to their fullest.
And when you say that there are those two people who are working with the kids, do you mean specifically with the Anchorage School District's kids who are in the gifted and highly gifted programs, or do you just mean in general?
I mean, they're part of the gifted program under our umbrella in the district.
Okay.
Our strategist, for example, if it's necessary, if he meets a student in the elementary school and he's still needed, he'll follow that student right up through high school graduation if we need to do that.
Well, I think this is a great time to hear this. Telling your child that they're smart seems like an encouraging and positive thing to say, right? Well, numerous studies on intelligence have shown that it can actually prevent them from continuing to engage in education. Stanford University psychology professor Dr. Carol Dweck is an internationally recognized expert in intelligence research. She found that praising children's efforts instead of their smarts encourages them to continue learning and growing all throughout life. Our producer, Sarah Gonzalez, recently spoke with Dr. Dweck.
Dr. Dweck, thank you for speaking with us on Kids These Days.
It's a pleasure.
So throughout your career as a researcher, you've looked at how ideas of intelligence can influence how children learn and what they will believe about themselves as a result of how they've been encouraged in their work.
Yeah.
And a few years ago, you conducted what's now a famous study of 400 fifth graders, and half of them were praised for their effort when completing a task, and the other half were praised for their intelligence. So for those of our listeners who may not be familiar with this study, would you mind recapping what you discovered in this research?
Well, what we discovered was really startling. We discovered that praising children's intelligence harms them. It makes them think that they can't make a mistake anymore. When you offer them a hard task they can learn from, they don't want it. They want an easy task. They want to stay in their comfort zone. They don't want to risk losing that kind of intelligence praise that you gave them. And then when they hit difficulty, they lose their motivation. They lose their enjoyment. And their performance becomes worse and worse. But we found that when we praise children's effort or the process they engaged in, their effort, their strategies, they overwhelmingly wanted a hard task they could learn from. They weren't risking anything. They knew that success came from applying yourself, and they wanted to do that. Then when they hit difficulty, they looked great. Many of them said the hard problems were their favorites. So this idea of focusing on the process armed them with a way to approach learning and a way to be resilient in the face of difficulty.
So the children who were told, wow, you must be really smart, were unwilling to take on any task that might challenge that praise. Is that right?
Exactly. Because if when they were successful, you're telling them they're smart, they think, oh, if I struggle or get some things wrong, you won't think I'm smart anymore. I won't be smart.
Okay. Let's talk about mindset. As a result of your years of research on intelligence, you have written a book called Mindset, The New Psychology of Success. And the ideas in that book you've now developed into an online curriculum called Brainology. And both are based on the idea of mindsets. So you have what you've termed the growth mindset and the fixed mindset. So first, explain to us, what is a fixed mindset?
A fixed mindset is when a child believes that their intelligence, their talents, their abilities, these are just fixed traits. You have them or you don't, or you have a certain amount and that's that. And in our years of research, we've shown that when a child has this fixed mindset, they shy away from difficult tasks and they really crash when things get hard or when they fail.
Okay, and then the growth mindset would be?
Growth mindset is the idea that your talents and abilities are things that can be developed through hard work, passionate dedication, through instruction and mentoring. And it doesn't mean everyone's the same or that anyone can be anything, but it means that your abilities can grow over time based on what you put into it.
You're saying then that intelligence is like a fluid concept. It's something that can grow and can change over time. Is that right?
Exactly. And it's not just me. The neuroscientists are now seeing that the brain has so much more plasticity, ability to grow and reorganize than we ever imagined. And cognitive psychologists are now isolating the basic components of intelligence and starting to teach them, not just to young kids, but to adults as well. So, yes, more than we ever believed, science is now showing intelligence is something fluid that can be encouraged and developed.
So it seems to me like the growth mindset idea really flies in the face of beliefs like, I'm not a math person, or I'm not a literature person, that there are different kinds of learning, that people who think logically can't understand literature. I mean, what do you think about those beliefs?
Those labels, I'm not a math person, drive me crazy because, you know, we often tell kids those things in a well-meaning way, so they don't feel bad about the fact that maybe they have to struggle a little in math. But you often hear it told to a six-year-old or a seven-year-old, how do you know you're not a math person? You're six, you're seven. And it gives them permission never to work hard again in math, never to try, never to believe that they can do it. In fact, many people who become very good in math were not whizzes initially. And often when kids are struggling initially, there are a couple of concepts they haven't mastered yet. They haven't broken through. And when they do, they can really thrive. So I think in our zeal to prevent children from having a moment of discomfort, we're excusing them from pursuing things that are really important to so many different careers later on that they might have loved.
You've spoken about the importance of these ideas in younger children and early education. I've noticed that in your ongoing research that you're looking at how the growth mindset idea works in higher education, which is really interesting because I think some people might say that by that age, your intelligence is set in stone, but you've found evidence to the contrary. So what have you found in your research involving older students?
So let me first say that cognitive psychologists are now training intelligence in college students. So that's really exciting and very much speaks against the idea that by that age, you have what you have. But also, we've shown very clearly that a growth mindset plays an important role in the achievement of college students. We followed students over very difficult curricula like pre-med organic chemistry or like advanced calculus, and we've shown that the mindsets play a very important role in whether they thrive in those courses. Also, there have been studies that taught college students a growth mindset and saw quite interesting gains in their grade point average, in their valuing of academics, and in their enjoyment of academics.
Let's wrap up by speaking to parents. They may wonder, is it okay for me to tell my kid that they're smart or not? What do you say to them?
I say, don't do that. Focus on the process they're engaging in. So, yeah, you studied really hard for that exam and you got an A. That's terrific. You put in extra hours and your grade has increased, or you've mastered that. Or when they bring a report card home, you ask them, what did you learn in these courses? And the point is, they should always be challenged and keep on learning. And this is what's going to take them far in the future. I would keep away from "you're really smart." It does not, in our research, it has never helped children.
Dr. Carol Dweck, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
You're very welcome.
Dr. Carol Dweck spoke with us from her office in Palo Alto, California. You can learn more about her work and watch a super interesting video of one of her experiments by visiting kidsthesedays.org, and we'll link you to it. Kids These Days today is discussing gifted and talented students and the special education they can get in Alaska. I'm joined by Peter Lubicich of the Anchorage School District, Annie Bill of the Matanuska Borough School District, and Susan Dulong Langley, who's a board representative for the National Association of Gifted Children. And Susan, I'd like to invite you to give the first response to that piece that Sarah Gonzalez just produced.
Thank you so much. Dr. Dweck was one of the keynote speakers at last year's convention for the National Association for Gifted Children, because this really is important research for this field. As it is for all fields. And what I liked were the examples that she gave really follow the guidelines that she has set out, of course, which are that the compliments should be specific and sincere, related to effort, and intermittent, that we don't necessarily, it doesn't help a child if we're praising every little single bit of effort. They, you know, need to build that tolerance for having some self-worth in that. But I think the big bonus of this is that it gives the child back, or individual back, a sense of control. That if you're told, well, you are intelligent, you figure, okay, I have what I was given, and it has to be enough. And if it's ever not, well, there comes that, panic. That crisis of realism. Whereas if you put it back to them and say, look what you're doing with what you've got, and look at the growth and look at the effort, again, that's putting the control back in their hands, and that helps to build the resiliency, which I think is a key for this population of learners, the ability to take a challenge and persevere through difficulties.
Mm-hmm. And Peter Lubicich, you've been a teacher for a long time with this population. And what Dr. Dweck was talking about with this whole idea of a growth mindset or a fixed mindset, did you encounter this with students when you were a teacher?
Frequently. I think that this happens in many cases, not explicitly, but unintentionally. The gifted student goes to school and they're not challenged and their needs aren't met and school is really easy and they can not work very hard, behave themselves, and receive tremendous compliments and a straight-A report card year after year after year. We're not looking at that student and saying, you're smart, but they can look at that, and they've gotten A's and everything, positive comments, without ever really having to push themselves hard. And later on, at some point, it could be middle school, it could be a more challenging teacher, whatever it is, if they haven't ever had to really push themselves to their limits and really work hard, those frustrations and those issues and the underachievement problems and things of that nature can come up. One of the things I used to tell my students was, if I gave you something too easy to do or that's not challenging enough, you should be angry with me. You should be insulted that I haven't given you something at your level. And I found it rewarding when a student would come up to me and say that you've insulted my intelligence, because that's my fault as the teacher, not providing something to meet your needs. And at the individual level, we need to make sure that gets done with kids. They have to be challenged, and that A or that comment really has to mean something. Otherwise, we're training kids to underachieve without really meaning to do so.
Annie, Bill, do you ever see this play out in your district?
Absolutely. And one of the key things we should remember as parents and teachers is that through our school programs and our district-wide programs, statewide programs, we are providing absolutely rigorous, challenging opportunities, especially at the secondary level, for our children so that they do have that opportunity to challenge themselves. And for example, as Peter was speaking, it reminded me of one of our schools in our district, Palmer High School, is one of the world schools for International Baccalaureate. And they have a program at the junior and senior level where the students take classes that are college level, and it's a tremendously rigorous, interdisciplinary, international program. And those children, not all of them are gifted kids, but they're all willing to work really hard and produce amazing papers, produce interdisciplinary responses to world problems. And this sets the stage for them to be to earn that confidence and to earn those soft skills that they need to be successful either in a career right out of high school or for college prep. So it's really important for our schools to provide those kinds of opportunities. Another example would be advanced placement classes, mm-hmm. or online classes that go into foreign language learning or whatever it is that a student might be interested in. We should have a wide variety of opportunities for children to take advanced level classes that can serve them for their future.
Well, I'm really glad you bring that up, because since we have both Peter and Annie in this conversation, you're from the two largest school districts in the state. I would like, since many of our listeners live in those two districts, what specifically are the programs that, I'll start with you, Annie, with the MATSU, since you talked about the International Baccalaureate program and some AP classes, but starting from the youngest kids and going through the school years, what programs does your district offer?
Okay, in the MATSU at the primary level, we're focusing on identifying children, but then we give them enrichment opportunities. And the key here, I think, is it's not just for those identified talented and gifted kids, but it's for a school-wide enrichment model. So we'll have special clubs, spelling club or geography bee or a robotics club or one school's doing sign language. And then we give the children an opportunity to participate in the clubs and then maybe participate in a school competition or a district-wide competition. Then at the middle levels, we advance to not just having enhancement opportunities, but we focus on academic acceleration. So children will have an opportunity to take honors level classes in the middle school years or advanced classes they can get high school credit for, like Algebra 1. Some schools even provide geometry and honors language arts. And then at the high school level, all of our largest schools in the MATSU provide either AP or, as I mentioned, at Palmer High, the International Baccalaureate program, which are very stringent, rigorous programs that they can get college credit for if they so desire, and can give them a great step ahead as they approach their college years.
Mm-hmm. And Peter Lubicich, tell us about the Anchorage School District and what specific programs there are for the gifted population.
Now, in Anchorage, we have six different programs that we operate. At the elementary school level, we have an enrichment program that serves kids in grades 2 through 6 district-wide. And we also have our highly gifted component that's a self-contained program. Again, it serves kids district-wide, but it's their regular classroom and instruction. When kids transition to middle school, they're put on a team where they receive gifted level instruction in science and language arts. At the high school level, our highly gifted program continues. That's offered at West High School in Anchorage, as is the International Baccalaureate program. All the high schools in Anchorage offer AP courses and honors and advanced coursework. And then for juniors and seniors, we offer a gifted mentorship program where those students can do a career exploration or the equivalent of a college internship. Our coordinators would pair them up with a professional or someone in their field of interest in the community. And that has been a real interesting program, too. It surprised me how many really talented high school students that are capable of college work anywhere will do an internship or a mentorship and come back and say, I'm glad I did this because I wasn't interested in that field at all. And others will like it and go on with it. But it's a good way for a real advanced student to learn about themselves, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of juniors and seniors, being a nerd wasn't always the coolest label to have pinned on you. In previous generations, kids would go to great lengths to avoid being called nerdy because smart kids either didn't have athletic ability, couldn't get dates, or spent all their time reading or studying. Well, that was the stereotype anyway. So what's it like to be a nerd nowadays? We thought Kids These Days' own teen blogger might have a thing or two to say about that. High school senior Patrick Walgren shares his thoughts about being a 21st century nerd.
I am a nerd, and I am proud of it. That's the trend that's emerging in Alaskan high schools today. Nerds are no longer those quiet, insecure kids with thick glasses and backpacks bursting with books. Nowadays, nerds are more than someone to steal lunch money or homework from. They participate in sports, student government, and go to school dances. Yes, this means that the modern nerd actually has a social life. Gasp! It's not like the nerds are revered as gods, and most people probably won't go as far to call them cool. But among nerds, most are happy and confident with their choice of staying in and writing college essays, as opposed to doing whatever it is that the cool kids are doing right now. I think this real-life Revenge of the Nerds started for me in elementary school. I remember my fifth grade teacher telling the class to be nice to nerds, because one day they'll be your boss. I laughed at the time and told myself that I could have the best of both worlds. I could make fun of nerds now and be their boss later. I hadn't yet realized my own nerd pedigree, but I had been told I was smart, so I believed it. But that line always subconsciously stuck with me, and I am prepared to apply it if I'm ever made fun of. I'll just retort with the fact that, okay, I'm a nerd. At least I won't be flipping burgers at age 30 like some people. With more and more people going to college, an emphasis is placed on the intellectually gifted since day one. Countless kids I know were in Ignite, an elementary school program for gifted students that encourages them to think outside the box. But curiously, some kids I know, and considered to be very smart, were never in programs like Ignite. They weren't picked, so they worked even harder than most of the gifted kids. It's a testament to the statement that intelligence is worth nothing without work ethic. This trend continues as the budding nerds grow older. In sixth grade, Golden View Middle School offers a zero-hour, before-school, pre-algebra class to gifted students, putting them 2 years ahead of the normal sixth grader. In high school, all students with a 3.5 GPA or higher are recognized at an assembly, and last year at Service High School, there were over 300 students that achieved that GPA. While our numbers continue to grow, nerds aren't really the epitome of cool. There probably won't be movies made glorifying the life of a nerd, just more making fun of them, because that's funnier. But you can bet that the movie producer, movie director, executive producer, and soundmaster who make that movie are all nerds in their own right. They might not shout it from the rooftops, but they know they wouldn't be where they are today if it wasn't for their brains. I'm Patrick Walgren.
Thank you, Patrick. This is Kids These Days. And in the time that we have left, I know that each of you is a parent, and I would like some practical advice from you about how do parents do their best if they are raising a gifted child. Annie, let me start with you.
Well, first of all, I asked permission for my daughter to speak about her, and she did give me permission. And I think the most important thing is you have to love your children unconditionally. You have to give them as many opportunities as you possibly can. And part of that is not expecting the schools, the teachers, the school district to do everything that is necessary to help your child learn and grow. And then after the opportunities, give them an opportunity to fail so that they learn that through their effort, there's when they're going to make the best achievements, not something that becomes easy for them. So those three things, and going back to the unconditional love, support them not only in the early years, but all the way through, you know, adulthood, and as long as they need that parental support.
Susan DeLong Langley, let's hear from you.
Oh, thank you. I'd like to address the issue of asynchronous development, which is the fact that these students might have extraordinary intellectual gifts, but they're still children. And they usually are still on par with age-appropriate social and emotional concerns, or sometimes they might be delayed. And we'll have parents that will come to us asking questions about their over-empowered child, and we have to step back and say, well, you hit the nail on the head. They're still children. They still need those boundaries, those limits, because sometimes parents even will remark that they get a little bit caught up because a very precocious child can really talk a good game. They can really be persuasive, especially if they enjoy engaging in intellectual debate. So remembering that they're children and providing that unconditional love that Annie referred to, and also be prepared for unexpected development of gifts. In my case, I came home to find my daughter watching political coverage after school when she was 11 years old. And I thought, well, you know, gee, that was interesting. And it turned out that that was a great passion of hers. And so to then support her, again, as Annie said, we found ourselves at, you know, local political conventions, and she ultimately went on to study political communication. So being prepared for the unexpected and having that sense of humor and remembering that they're children and they need to hit those developmental milestones along the way, and that there are resources out there. The two that I will highlight are, of course, our website for the National Association for Gifted Children, and also the SENG.org, which is Supporting the Emotional Needs of the Gifted. They have a wonderful wealth of resources for parents and for students.
Well, that, regrettably, is all the time that we have today. Susan DeLong Langley is a parent representative on the board of directors for the National Association for Gifted Children. Annie Bill works for the Matanuska-Susitna Borough School District and coordinates its talented and gifted programs. And Peter Lubichich is the supervisor of the Anchorage School District's gifted and highly gifted programs. Thanks to each of you for being with us today. It's been a pleasure.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Did you know we're not only on the radio, we're also on the web. At kidsthesedays.org, you'll find all 50 of our shows, original blogs about travel, cooking, raising kids, and more. It's a great resource, and everything there is there all the time, and it's all free. Absolutely for you to share and use. And a reminder, calling all young writers 10 to 20 years old, we want to hear from you. There are just a few days left to enter our essay contest. Tell us what you think it means to be a kid these days, and you could be on the radio. All the information is on our website. Go to kidsthesedays.org/essay contest. Kids These Days had help today from our teen blogger and high school senior Patrick Walgren. Don't forget to find out what Patrick's talking about each and every Wednesday in Patrick on the Edge. That's the blog he writes exclusively for Kids These Days. Jessica Cochran and Sarah Gonzalez both reported for today's show from Anchorage. Jessica is our regular contributor, assistant producer, and technical editor. Sarah is our producer, business manager, contest coordinator, and online content guru. I'm Shanna Sheehy. Thanks for spending time with me today on Kids These Days, and we'll see you next time.
The ideas, opinions, and commentary you hear on Kids These Days are those of the hosts, guests, and contributors, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of its funders or broadcast partners. The Content Producers Guild is solely responsible for what you hear on the program. Kids These Days is made possible by a generous grant from the Association of Alaska School Boards and its Initiative for Community Engagement. Kids These Days is produced in partnership with KSKA 91.1 FM Anchorage, KRUA, and the UAA Department of Journalism and Public Communications.